Welcome to another Freebie Friday edition of the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. I'm really glad to be with you on this this really special episode of Life 2.0. I've been trying to think how to set this up for a week. This is probably the fourth or fifth edition of this introduction. I've got rid of the other ones because they just didn't seem right to me. They didn't seem to be the setup that I was looking for and adequately communicate how important this particular podcast is today. So I'm going to try this again. And the lessons are many in here for me, but the overarching one seems to be, as I revisit it again and again and again, that sometimes the universe really does some amazing things. And my life is, I've had a lot of those, but this is in the top three of my life of the how in the world did all this come together? How is it possible that I get to be witness to this? How is it possible I get to participate in this process? So let me see if I can set this up for you in a way that after four or five attempts seems to be accurate. 1968, I was 9 going on 10. And every summer, we would go on vacation to the bustling metropolis of Appleton, Wisconsin, which is about a three-hour drive north of Chicago. My dad worked in banking his whole life, and so he'd get a week or two off, whatever it was. And at some point, we'd go up there for a few days, and my mom's family was all from Wisconsin, so we'd go up and see all our cousins. And for a kid like me, that spent most of his time in the city, I think I should have been dropped off on a farm because I loved it there. Got to go up on the hayloft and go ride a tractor and go shoot guns, and it was fantastic. Run through the cornfields at Uncle Ronnie's farm and go watch Uncle Ray in the stock car races, and go to Uncle Dick's house and ride the garden tractor. I mean, these were all huge events in my life. Not that my life was devoid of excitement in Chicago. It's just a different kind of excitement. So we'd go up there every year. It was a big deal. We'd get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you know, we'd drive north and stay at the Dreamland Motel right on the frontage road off of College Avenue and U.S. Highway 41. And we'd stuff ourselves with French toast at Big Boy's restaurant, and it was just a grand time. But in the summer of 1968, my dad, as I recall this, he was, you know, we were going like either he was going right back to work or we were dropping him off at work or something on this return trip. And so he hadn't shaved for a few days. He goes out and buys a razor. And what he got was Persona electrocoated blade. Like that was like a big deal back then. More importantly, he was given a premium gift because he bought that razor or that blade. And the gift was a book called Instant Replay, The Green Bay Diary of Jerry Kramer, also written by Dick Shapp, the late great sports writer. And my dad came back, and I don't know if he did it for effect or what the deal was, but he came back to the motel. We were packing our bags, and he looked at the book, and on the cover is Kramer sitting there, number 64, the right guard for the Green Bay Packers. And he looked at it, and he just says, you know, this, we're not taking this book back to Chicago, and he tossed it in the garbage can. Little metal trash can in the bathroom at the motel. And that was sacrilegious in our family. We had a floor-to-ceiling, 12-foot-long bookcase with everything from Mickey Spillane to, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica. In between was all about reading. And so for my dad to put a book in the garbage, I thought, what in the world? On the other hand, I think he did it to pique my curiosity, and he got me. When he left the room, I went and fished the book out of the garbage can. And on the trip back from Appleton to Chicago at 60 miles an hour, I was able to go cover to cover with Vince Lombardi and the Green Bay Packers. It was a astonishing and astounding download for me. It wasn't about football as much as it was about discipline, about teamwork. It was about camaraderie, leadership, all the things that go into that game that I had yet really to play anything further than midget football. So it wasn't about the Packers. It was almost not even about Lombardi. And it wasn't even about Kramer, except for the fact that Kramer was the messenger. He was the delivery system of all this stuff. And I just was enamored with the book. I still have it all these years later, that beat-up, tattered copy of Instant Replay, The Green Bay Diary of Jerry Kramer. And I've read it every football season since 1968. That's 50 years. So 25 years later, probably somewhere in there, I can't exactly remember when, I was working on a project with a guy who played for the Chicago Bears at the time. He was a Super Bowl champ. We were working on a project called the Pro Athlete Insider Magazine. It was doing very well. We were putting together an advisory team. And I said to this guy, my partner, who was from San Diego, I said, you know, we got to get Jerry Kramer involved in this. This, you know, he's like, Jerry who? Like, wait, what? He's a California guy. So he had no real clue about the history of the Packers and all the rest of this stuff, even though he had played in the NFL. Somehow through the NFL Players Association, I got Jerry's number. I called. This gravel voice is on the other end of the line in Boise, Idaho. And my knees are knocking and my lips quivering and my fingers are shaking. And I probably had a tear in my eye when I explained who I was and what we were doing and if he'd be involved. And he gave me his pat, well, hell, kid, let's see what happens with this. And in the following week, he was going to be in Appleton, go figure, at the Paper Valley Hotel to do a roast, the Max McGee roast, of Willie Davis, who played defensive end for the Green Bay Packers back when Jerry played. And so this was 1989, somewhere in there. And my partner and I drove from Chicago up to Appleton. We walked into the room, the Paper Valley Hotel, and I liken it to saying there was like 300 farmers in there wearing overalls that had all paid, you know, a couple hundred bucks to take up a seat and listen to the glory days of the Green Bay Packers. And I was just struck by the connection that these people had to that team and the guys that were up front, Jerry Kramer and Bart Starr and Willie Wood. And it was just incredible. So all these years later, we've remained friends since that time. We've had a lot of great adventures together. I created an event called Lessons from Lombardi that I kind of was the moderator, and I asked Jerry a bunch of questions. We were on stage. It was just a very incredibly moving performance from this guy who I think is like Emerson with a football helmet. So he's been turned down or dismissed from the Pro Football Hall of Fame 10, 12, 13 times. I don't know, over the years. It's one of the most mind-boggling things in pro sports of how this guy who was on the all-NFL team for the first 50 years of the league, all pro more times you can count, Super Bowls 1 and 2 at Lombardi, all the championships that they had, that wasn't in the Hall of Fame. About 6 years ago, his daughter Alicia, 6, 8 years ago, mounted an online social media campaign and started building the numbers to get Jerry his due. And it happened. So what you're going to hear today was my conversation with Jerry back in June of this year. You're hearing this on Freebie Friday, the day before he's going into the Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. And the reason I'm so excited about this is really three things. Number one is, I don't know how this all happened. I don't know how a guy goes from throwing a book in the garbage, his son picks it out, and 50 years later, I'm going to watch that guy become inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So number one, there's no comprehension on my part. I've looked at it a thousand ways, and it never adds up. Just grateful for it. The second thing is the lessons that I've learned from that book through Kramer and the other people that played in that team have stayed with me like a blueprint. The discipline, the teamwork, the camaraderie, the strength, all the things that you need to play football. And I did well. I ended up, you know, high school football co-captain and went on to play college football, play semi-pro football, and those lessons even got more embedded in me. But it's all the years since I stopped playing football, which are quite a few now, 30 years, I think, that have played themselves out on a different field. So just to sit down and have the discipline to create and to push, and even if you can't see the score, you keep going. And it has helped me in so many ways I couldn't even count. But third, the thing that's been really on my mind the past week getting ready to have this show edited and put together was what Jerry's done off the field. You're going to hear some of that in this interview, this conversation we had. And I don't know that anybody else on that team, and again, this is not taking away from all the other Packers that are already in the Hall of Fame and all the Packers that played on those great teams, and of course, the late, great Vince Lombardi. I just have not seen anybody live these lessons or these ideals or these disciplines like Jerry has. I mean, I've seen it when no one else has seen it. We've been at dinner and people have walked up and he sat down and he just poured this stuff out. And it's like he's on this mission to deliver the mail. And I so relate to that. We've had listen, this could be a 6-hour podcast. We went up from I picked them up in Milwaukee one time. We were going north. We drove 6 hours, but first we had to get out of the bar to get going. And, you know, the conversation, that car, I wish we could have recorded that. So it's not it's the real deal. This isn't like you're looking for a life coach certification. This is what it's like when you're one of the least likely prospects to be going to the Hall of Fame as a draft pick in 1958 that's had more medical maladies to overcome than I don't think anybody else has ever played the game of pro football, and he still delivers the mail. So I'm thrilled. I'm honored. I'm excited for you to hear this conversation the day before Jerry Kramer goes into the Hall of Fame. It's so interesting to me as a Chicago guy that for 30 years, I've been in the orbit of a guy who played for the effing Green Bay Packers. And I'm here with Jerry Kramer. We're in Milwaukee on a gorgeous summer day. And before we do anything else, before we talk about your journey, before we talk about some of the work you're doing with stem cell research, stem cell research, right? Before we get into all that and the stories and the things we always jaw about every time we're together, congratulations.
Thank you, Johnny. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I've had a lot of congratulations, and almost all of them are followed by, "It's about time."
I never thought I'd see it. You know, I was coming up with a list of things I never thought I'd see. Yeah. The Cubs win a World Series. Yeah. Never thought I'd see it. Bruce Jenner not be Bruce Jenner. Never thought I'd see it.
I don't believe it yet.
Yeah, I know. But there's this list, and it's somewhere around 8, 9, or 10, I thought. I don't think I'd ever see 64 going into Canton. Millions of Packer fans and football fans have followed this for years. Now, I wish Alisa was here, because I was watching a clip the other day which I thought was perfect. There's a clip, you're at home, and you're telling the story about when Alisa came 4, 5, 6 years ago and said, "Dad, I want to do this," and you said, "Please don't."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. She pays the same amount of attention to me as her mother does.
What an interesting, amazing journey just between you and your daughter.
You know, it has certainly brought us a lot closer together and bonded us even more so than we were. But it was interesting to see her start out, and I thought, well, you know, she'll go down the road here a little ways and get tired of it and get into something else, and it'll be forgotten. And what she did to really get herself as a believer, she found a young guy named Randy at a PR company in Boise, and she was talking to him about it, and he said, "Well, what about the other Hall of Famers? How do they feel about Jerry?" And she says, "Well, I think most of them are in favor of him being in the Hall. I really don't know." He said, "Well, let's get him to write a letter." So they got 60 to 65 guys in the Hall, like Merlin Olsen, like Bob Lilly, like Alex is not in the Hall, but right. Alex wrote a letter, Roger Staubach, 65.
All your peers.
All my peers, the guys that I played with, Johnny, and the guys that I played against. So those letters convinced her that I really belonged in the Hall of Fame. And they did a lot for me, too. I adopted the attitude, well, I would rather have this group of guys believe that I belonged in the Hall of Fame than be in the Hall of Fame and have them believe that I didn't belong in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
So that salved my little ego and my little tippy boat a great deal. And I kind of accepted the possibility that I was not going to be in the Hall of Fame. I finally sat down with myself several years ago and said, "Hey, you've had a wonderful ride. The game has been sensational. You've had some experiences that you could never dream, coming out of Jordan, Montana with 352 people," right? And so it was a wonderful journey, and I decided that the game had given me 100 prizes, 100 gifts, and they hadn't given me one. So was I going to let that one they didn't give me spoil 100 that they did give me?
Mm-hmm.
No, that would be stupid. Mm-hmm. So grow up. Get your little trembly lip taken care of and enjoy the journey that you have and what they've given you.
I remember after the first, this is probably the first go around when the nomination didn't even come through. And I texted Alicia and I said, "How's it going?" She said, "We're fishing." And that seemed to be the out. You know, yeah. Let's just go fishing. So yeah. you did that. And the second time around, I watched it build and build and build again. And I thought, this is really going to be interesting because it was a groundswell. It went from those 65 letters of Hall of Famers and peers to literally thousands and then hundreds of thousands of letters from people who, you know, for the most part, the fan doesn't have a whole lot of say in stuff that goes on in a football or any sport.
Yeah.
But this is different. This, to my knowledge, might be the first and only time that a daughter, for sure, has mounted a campaign that got the fans involved that put enough leverage on the Pro Football Hall of Fame to make it all happen.
Joe Horrigan, president, Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
They notify me about last August or something like that, and they call me and congratulate me and whatnot, and Joe gets on the phone, and he said, Jerry, I want you to know that your nomination is going to reduce my incoming mail by 90%. He said, those Packer fans have questioned my intelligence, my parentage, they've questioned everything about me. And I'm so tickled that you're nominated again.
You know, what a ride that is. And then to watch it actually take place. They did a great job at the Super Bowl. You know, I'm sitting in Chicago. I texted you guys at the Super Bowl, and I'm sitting there with two shots of Wild Turkey, one for you and one for me, thinking, damn it, if I have to drink both these myself because you didn't get in, I'll do it. But the knock came on the door. What was that like?
Well, you're in a emotional roller coaster to begin with. You know, the whole time period leading up to it is, are you going to? No, you're not. Yes, you will. Maybe you will. No, you don't. What are you going to do? Well, I'm going to tell them what to do with that Hall of Fame stuff, and I don't care if I make it. And yes, you do. I really might. So you're just in an emotional mess. And so they tell us at the function at the Super Bowl that they will knock on the door between 3 and 4 in the afternoon. And if you make it into the Hall of Fame, the chairman, David Baker, will come to the door and he will
Hard guy to miss.
David
is a large human.
6'9". 400 pounds, and he knocks like 6'9", 400 pounds, right? So we're getting along about 3:15 or 3:20, and I see a television clip of Rick making a presentation for me. And I goes, oh, they did that early, so they'll notify us early. So if I'm going to go in, they'll probably be here between 3:15 and 3:30. I'll be one of the first guys they notify because I was one of the first guys they voted on.
Mm-hmm.
And so 3:15 gets here and 3:30 gets here and 3:35 gets here and 3:36 and 3:37. And there's a knock on the door. And I got about 20 people in the room, three or four of the kids and Charlie and the whole group. And everybody cheers and everybody hoots and hollers and yahoo and yippee and dippity-doo-dah. And I go to the door and it's a maid. And she's like a deer in the headlights.
Yeah,
right? She's what is going on? What happened? What? And so then the chatter kind of stops.
Yeah,
the false chatter and the fill in the air with noise. So you're not uncomfortable.
Yeah,
that stops and it gets very uncomfortable. And it's 3:37, 3:40, 3:42, he's getting around the corner.
Clock's dragging.
Yeah, I'm sure the janitor's coming instead of Mr. Baker, and I'm sure he's going to say, Jerry, we've got your room rented, you know, it's time for you to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden this boom, boom, boom hits the door, and we know who it is. You just got to know. And I get about halfway to the door, and being a smart aleck, I say, who is it? And I get there, and he's giggling and laughing.
Yeah.
And he's got six or seven photographers and media people with him. And he's got a big smile, and he's giggling. And I said, you are the most beautiful man I have ever seen. I don't know that I've ever seen a beautiful man, but you're one. And he giggled and gave me a big hug and said, you're in, Jerry. You made it. So, wow. And then you go through the, did I dream this? Did I imagine that? Is my mind playing tricks with me?
Really?
Is somebody messing with me or something?
Yeah.
And so it's still, you go back and forth still for quite a bit. And we on the day following the Super Bowl, on Monday, we were fitted for a bust and a gold jacket and a ring. And I'm getting the gold jacket on. I'm sitting and getting the tailor there. He's giving me measurements and whatnot. And I look over at Alicia, and she and Charlie are about 20 feet away watching, sitting there. And she is just streaming tears. She just totally lost it and is just crying as hard as she's ever cried before. And Charlie doesn't know exactly what's going on.
Right.
Charlie's five.
If Papa's getting a jacket, Mom's crying.
Yeah. Right. So it turned out to be a wonderful, wonderful weekend and a glorious moment.
When did you know that the only person that could possibly do the introduction at the hall was Alicia?
Immediately. Just immediately. I didn't talk to anybody about it. I think Wink called me and said, who are you going to have introduce you? I said, Alicia. And the boys asked about it and thought it was a great idea. And everybody is aware of her contribution, of her work, of her effort, of the time she's put into this. So it really wasn't a decision. It was obvious to everyone that Alicia should do that. And, well, Dad, don't you normally have a coach or a teammate or something like that? I don't know what you normally do, but I don't know anybody that deserves it more than Alicia. So that's where I am. You got an idea? Let's hear it. And there were no ideas, so we're all comfortable with that.
I bet it was in 2012, which would have been maybe the second go-round. I can't. You've been up for nomination so many times, I lost count.
Just 11.
Just a mere 11.
Yeah.
2012, I believe it was. I was doing an overnight stint on CBS, KMOX out of St. Louis, but I did the show from Chicago. And I asked Leisha if she wanted to get on and talk about the effort at that point, which is now, what, 6 years ago? Oh, my gosh. And she said, sure. Well, the problem was, or the challenge was, it was 2 a.m. in Boise. And she got up at 2 o'clock in the morning. Do you know this?
No.
Got up at 2 o'clock in the morning, like it was 9 a.m., like she was all ready to go for the day. And I didn't say a hell of a lot for 40 minutes. I just listened.
Wow.
And so did about 3 million people.
Wow.
And when we were finished, you know, I would get phone calls and stuff. And this was just a week for me. I was filling in for a guy, but it was still a nationwide show. And what she talked about, the things that I recall, you know, she doesn't remember you playing.
No.
Right. You were done in 68, so there was no recollection of that.
Right.
And I was trying to get to the point when, how did you know, how did she know when she was supposed to undertake it? And she said, I'm not really sure, but the more I uncovered, because my dad doesn't throw anything out.
That's right.
The garage is a museum. I've seen
dad,
it.
Dad, as a point, has a newspaper from Sandpoint, Idaho, when he was a freshman in high school. And he was on the track team, and he finished fourth in the shot put. And it's the first time he ever got his name in the newspaper.
That's a keeper.
And he's a keeper.
That's right.
It's a keeper.
That's right.
That's exactly right.
But she was alluding to that. She was going through all this stuff, and she thought, maybe there's a way I can help my dad. And that the crux of all of this goes back to that thought, which to me is, it's things you and I have talked about for decades, about, you know, what is it that moves a person, and how do you take control of that? Where's that fire in the burn, as you always talk about? So we did this show, 2 o'clock in the morning, and when we get to the end of it, and I'm letting her go off the air privately, she says, did I do okay? I didn't say anything for 45 minutes. It's your show, basically, you know? So I know that she'll hear this at some point, and myself, and along with all the people that knew you should have been in years ago, something also tells me it had to go this way. Like, if it would have, I said it a couple years ago, I said this to you, you know, I've always felt that the hall needed you more than you needed it.
Yeah.
And now it's reversed itself, I think, because of her efforts and all the people. So I'll be there in August. I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to – she's going to cry, you know. She's not going to say anything. She's going to cry, my dad. It's going to be great.
Let me tell you one quick story
sure.
about her and her competitive drive and her spirit. When she was an eighth grader, summertime, so she's going to be a freshman in high school, and we've got a hoop out on the garage door, and I'm shooting hoops with her. She loves to play basketball, and I'm trying to coach her a little bit and show her a couple things, and she doesn't want to have me coach her. She wants to compete with me.
Oh.
And so I'm struggling a little bit trying to help, and she comes home one day and says, Dad, there's a basketball camp at Boise State for 3 days, and I'd like to go. I said, now that's a great idea. And I'm thinking to myself, some of those big, tall country girls will get her in that basketball court and stuff her.
Yeah.
And she'll come home and ask Dad, oh, I need some help, Dad. And I said, that's wonderful. I think that's a great idea.
Who do I write the check to? Yeah. See you, right?
So she went to camp. She came home. I was out of town. I came home. I said, Leash, how'd the camp go? I finished first in the one-on-one, and my team finished third, and I learned some moves, and I'm going to burn you.
So, eighth grade going into high school.
Eighth grade going into high school. She's going to burn me. So that's Alicia.
Well, it's the whole thing, and if you're catching us late, I'm talking with Jerry Kramer. We're in Milwaukee. You're on a road trip.
Yeah.
Well, now you're the big shit again, right? Because, now everybody wants you. You always were, but now you're really the top dog.
Well, I'm doing some things, Johnny, that I've done for years. I've had some engagements, commercial engagements, mm-hmm. but I've got the Lombardi Golf Tournament coming up Friday and Saturday, mm-hmm. and I've done that for 45
sure.
years. And I've got the Boys and Girls Club Golf Tournament in Door County. That I've done for the last 8 or 10 years. And so I'm trying to give something back and continue to help out mm-hmm. as much as I can. I feel a great debt to the Packer fan. It happened. How much time have I got? We all right?
You just keep talking, Chief.
We had a situation my final year in Green Bay. And, you never really pay a lot of attention to the fans. You're with the guys and your buds, and you're having a deal, and you're out on the field, and you can't see more than 3 feet with this big defensive giant across mm-hmm. the line of scrimmage from you. So we're playing Baltimore, last game of the season, in Green Bay, and we're technically eligible, but we need a plane crash and a train wreck and a couple other things to happen for us to get in, but we're alive.
Yeah.
So we know we're going to beat Baltimore. So end of the game, 4 minutes to go. We get the ball. We're down 3 points, and we get the ball in our 20, and bing, bang, bing, bang, bing. We're going down the field 7 yards, 10 yards, 8 yards, 5 yards, 7 yards. We go cross midfield. We're down to the 35-yard line. We know we're going to score. We always have. We always will. We fumble. I look up at the clock, a minute and 15 seconds to go. It's over. It's over.
Mm-hmm.
The era is over. Coach Lombardi is general manager this year. Phil Bengtson is the head coach. So I take a deep breath, and I start to walk toward the sidelines, and I'm lost in the whole thought of next. What's next now? This is over. And I hear a smattering of applause, and I'm going, it's over. Don't you know? It's over. We're going to lose. We're not going to the playoffs. We're not in the championship. We're not involved anymore. And I get closer to the bench, and the applause grows and grows and grows. And suddenly the whole stadium starts to stand.
You're having a hard time with this.
And they give us a standing ovation for about 5 minutes.
Oof.
And I say, they know. They knew the moment I knew that it's over. They're saying thank you.
You're tied right into it.
Thank you for yesterday. Thank you for all the victories. Thank you for everything you've done. And I went, wow, I didn't know they knew that, were that sophisticated as fans.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that moment, I developed an appreciation and a respect that has never wavered for the Packer fans.
There are some stories. We've been on a lot of adventures. Some I can't even talk about because the statute of limitations hasn't run out yet. But I've been in situations with you that to this day, some of these happened years and years ago. I still try to grasp it. I still try to get the meaning. I'm not sure how it happens or even why. And the one that comes to mind the most, I've talked about this before. I want to talk about this event we did a few years ago in Michigan, the Lessons in Lombardi, because it had less to do about football and more about life. But I'll get that in a minute. Years ago, it's got to be 15, 18 years ago, came up to Upper Michigan, and we were doing the Cabela's Super Bowl of Walleye Tournament. And we went fishing for a day, and it was all great. We were on some fishing show. It was all well and good. But we also played golf. And I had gotten a note that there was a gentleman who was in the last phase of his life, and wondered if we could stop by and he could say hi to you. And I have never tried to, I'm not your manager. I just try to pass things along. And I remember getting in the cart at the golf course at 9 o'clock and saying, hey, this is what I got, a note. And, you know, yeah, okay, let's play golf. You didn't say a word about it all day. We get to the end of the day and you say, so where's this fellow live now? It was literally 5 minutes from the golf course. Well, hell, let's go over there. We get to the guy's house, and they left the door ajar going into the garage, and then the door into the house was up into the kitchen. And this is a scene I'll never forget. So I'm behind you. You're walking up the 4 or 5 steps into the house, and as you open the door into the house, there's a gentleman in a high back chair with oxygen and needles in his arm and the whole drip going on, and pale and not doing good at all. And I'm looking under your left arm into the house, and you walk in and you yell, any Packer fans in here? And this guy turns his head and looks to our direction, and he rises out of the chair like Lazarus, and he says, hell of a block, Kramer. And for the next 45 minutes or an hour, you just sat with this guy who was in really dire straits. And I, much like you with the fans, they got it. I'm going, what the hell is going on here? Now, everybody claims that they were at the Ice Bowl, right? It only holds so many people. Sure. But this, there was something here. And as long as I've known you, and as many times as we've had this conversation, still unable for me to identify that.
Yeah. Well, there's an emotional involvement from the Packer fan. It just
but it's more than football.
Yeah. Say it again.
It's more than football.
No question about it. I have had at least 10,000 people come up to me at autograph sessions and say, we used to go to Grandma and Grandpa's every Sunday. Mom and Dad, all the kids, and we'd go to Grandma's house and she'd cook a big dinner. We'd have dinner and go in the living room and watch the Packers. And you couldn't walk in front of that TV set. And you couldn't talk either. So commingled with the Packers is the family and the experience with the family and Grandma and Grandpa, who may be gone now. But the Packers and the Grandma and Grandpa are part of their memory bank. And so that, I believe that's part of it, Johnny. I don't pretend to know it all, but I think that memory of the family and growing up with the Packers and Mom and Dad and everybody enjoying the games is part of it.
Do you think that the accessibility or the size of the Green Bay market had something to do with it?
I think so. They see us in town, you know, especially back when I played. They knew us, and pretty much everybody knew us. And if we were having a losing season like we did in 58.
Hey, tell the story about the woman you met getting off the plane, the old lady. Remember, you were going to play the Bears or something, and the old lady, you said, she went up and said, are you going to beat those Bears? Remember that one? Kind of gave you an
indicator.
Actually,
I met her in a cigar store, oh. Magazine
store. Was she
store.
Buying cigars?
No, oh. I was buying magazines, okay. Actually. And, are you a Packer? Yes, ma'am, I am. And she was dressed nice, had an elderly lady, but she had her glasses on and was kind of dressed up and looking good, right? And she says, are you going to beat those blankety-blank-blank Bears? And I looked at her, and my mouth flew open a little bit, and she didn't actually say blankety-blank-blank,
yeah, sure.
Right? And I, yes, ma'am. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. I think so. Yes,
yes,
ma'am.
Yes. Okay. Or you'll answer to her.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you, Johnny, you can tell, you know, from the letter or from the call or from whatever it is, Dad's having a tough time. Yeah. You're his favorite player. Have you got a minute or a few seconds or a little bit of time to say hello? Absolutely. You bet. Jerry, you're the biggest, strongest, neatest, handsomest, cutest, loveliest football player ever. Sign this for me.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we get a lot of those. Yeah. You know, and guys are conning you a little bit and sending this stuff. But I get some letters that bring tears to my eyes, Johnny, that I got a beautiful letter just a week, 10 days ago from a guy who had been a Packer fan all his life, and he was a Jerry Kramer fan, and I had impacted his life, and the books and the Coach Lombardi had impacted his philosophy of life and his morals, and on and on and on, and you've been a great influence in my life, and that's humbling. That's really humbling to have someone adult say that and mean it with great feeling and great emotion. I sent that to all my kids, by the way, and said, hey, Pop knows a couple things, you know.
Yeah,
listen
yeah.
to him a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's been an interesting transformation from me thinking I was paid by the Green Bay Packer organization to understanding that the fans pay my salary.
Mm.
They pay for everything that happens in Green Bay. And they're the ones that deserve thank you and appreciation and all of that. So it's really the fan that takes care of all of Packer Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a wonderful fan base, the best in the world. They're just over the top, John.
You know how hard it is for a Chicago guy to hear this crap? I mean, I love you, but you're pushing it, brother.
I tell you one thing, as an observer of the Chicago
Bears.
Oh,
here we go.
I think you have a great linebacker coach, or a guy who scouts linebackers.
True.
We go back to Bill George.
True.
We go to Butkus. We go to Singletary.
Yes.
We go to Urlacher.
Yes.
We got great middle linebackers. Now, if you could find a quarterback coach.
Wait a minute. Somebody once said when Cutler was playing that Cutler is the best player the Packers ever picked for the Bears.
We loved him.
Loved him. Throw another one.
And we loved all you.
Yeah.
The last great quarterback that played for the Chicago Bears, in my estimation, and this is just casual conversation, was 1942, and a fellow named Luckman.
Sid. Absolutely. And you mentioned Urlacher. You're going into the hall with him.
Yeah.
Very cool.
What a nice kid.
Yeah.
He is a sweetheart.
We loved him. Loved him. And, you know, he was kind of the embodiment of all those guys. Taller than Singletary, hit like Butkus, could cover the zone. Had a great time. So I'm loving to see you there, but I can't wait to see the big guy get his due, too.
I got acquainted with him, and my son Matt did, and he was very accessible.
Yeah.
He was very open. He was very friendly. He's a sweetheart.
Yep.
He's polite. He's thoughtful. Just a wonderful kid. So I'm a bit of an Urlacher fan.
You've done a lot for the retired players. It's one thing to be recognized for your efforts on the field. That's without question. Everybody's seen it. You can Wikipedia. You can watch YouTube videos up the wazoo. You can see the sweep. That's all there. But when you retired, you, for some reason, decided to take on the mantle of being for the guys. And you kind of got this whole thing about your Super Bowl ring on an airplane, which led to unbelievable changes for the retired players.
You know, Johnny, I had a wonderful group of teammates, guys that I loved, all colors, all sizes, all weights, all everything, but Green Bay Packers, and they made the team better, and I tried to make the team better. And when I saw them struggling, we had a situation where one of our guys was getting $179 a month as a pension after 12 years. In all world, right? And I said, that's not right. That's not fair. So I start giving the commission a little grief about it, and my ring comes back from 25 years in the wilderness.
Right, on an airplane. You washed your hands?
I washed my hand, put it, and the ring came off. I put it on the edge of the sink, went back and sat down. 3 minutes, I jump up and run back to the restroom, and it's gone.
Mm.
So 25 years later.
And nobody fessed up on an airplane.
Nobody. The captain came on the thing, and a psychic came up to me and said, I think a little gray-haired lady has it in a purse with a hanky wrapped around it.
On the plane?
A psychic. And she said she has a blue purse, and there are two straps across her wrist. So I went up and down the aisle looking for a little blue-haired lady that I could dope off and get my ring back. So didn't happen. 25 years later, a guy in Chicago calls me, Jerry, did you lose a ring? I did. Why? He said, I think I have it. I said, well, you better bring it back, or I'm going to call the patrol, or the FBI, the Marines. Everybody. He said, chill out a little bit. I'll get it back to you. I just want to make sure it's yours. So he did, and bless his heart, I had replaced it. So I decided to auction off the replacement ring and get into my complaining about the pensions and the disability in a serious way. So I started an organization called Gridiron Greats I've got $25,000 or something like that for the ring, and I put that in and some other funds down the way. But then I got Mike Ditka involved and a bunch of guys, Joe DeLamalier, Buffalo, and there was 8 or 10 guys there, my advertising guy and commercial guy. So we ultimately made enough noise to get the commissioner's attention. So he calls me one day at home, and he says, "Jerry, what are you trying to do with this?"
This is Goodell.
This is Goodell.
Yeah.
"With this Gridiron Greats thing." And I said, "Commissioner, we got a problem. We got boys sleeping in garages. We got them in homeless shelters. We got them in the street." I said, "We're better than that. We got to do something about it." "Well, what do you want out of this?" "Jerry, or Commissioner, I can't take care of this many guys. We need a lot of money. There's several thousand guys out there that need help." "Well, what do you want out of this?" "I want you to get involved. I want you to help out. But what do you want for yourself? What are you trying to do for Jerry? What do you want?" "I want to go fishing." I don't want to do this.
Right.
"I don't want to do this the rest of my life. I want you to help." So he said, "Okay, let's talk." So we had meetings for about 2 years, and the commissioner came up with the fund for the older players. I can't remember exactly what he called it, but it was $800 million. And the kid that was getting $179 a month is now getting $2,200 a month.
Takes the edge off.
Yeah. Yeah, and with Social Security, you know, he's getting $4,000 or $5,000 a month, and he can live on that. He can't go dancing much.
Yeah, sure.
But he can live on that.
Yeah.
So I just felt like it was something I could do, and if I could, I should. And so I was thinking about my guys and the great emotional bond that we shared.
Mm-hmm.
And Willie Davis is a great pal of mine, and he is a sensational human being, and we roomed together and had wonderful memories together and chatted a lot late into the night, like lights out, 11 o'clock, and we neither one of us sleepy, right? And I go, "Will, yeah, Jay?" I said, "You believe in black power?"
"No, in the dark, you said.
This is in the dark,
yeah, yeah.
Right, and it's during the 60s.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
"No, Jay, I don't believe in black power." "Huh. Huh. Hmm. Will, yeah, Jay? You believe in white power?" "No, Jay, I don't believe in white power." "Huh. Huh. Will, yeah, Jay? What do you believe in? What, you know, what the hell do you believe in?" "Green power, Jay. Green power." So Willie is a kid that grew up in Texarkana. His mama worked in the cotton fields. And daddy left home early. His mama wanted Willie to go to school and get an education. Willie played football for the Green Bay Packers and for 6 years went to the University of Chicago and got his MBA and was on the dean's list. And Dean Schultz was the guy at the time. And so Willie served on the boards of 17 major United States New York Exchange companies, as in Dow Chemical, MGM Grand, Sara Lee, Johnson Controls, Kmart, on and on and on. So Willie found the path of education for his life and for what he needed to do. And he just turned into he always was, I guess, but he revealed himself as a sensational human being. I love him. I've loved him since I first met him.
Every time we talk, you light up like a Christmas tree when you talk about this stuff. Do you know that?
No.
You just do.
No.
You just do. I mean, you get young. I've told you, I think I said, you get younger and younger as we talk. And I think part of it is, for me, as I observe this, you can draw a straight line from being the first, from the pick in 1958 through all of this stuff. Because without it, none of it's there.
Yeah.
You got to be, at some point, outside of pinching yourself about getting the phone call, or the knock on the door, I should say, even the phone call that you're going to be nominated finally. But at some point, I mean, how do you explain you lose a ring on a plane? Nobody fesses up. If they'd have fessed up, there's no fund. Feel like someone's tapping on your shoulder?
Yeah, I do. In fact, I look up every once in a while and said, "Am I supposed to do this?"
Yeah.
And the big fella says, "Yes. Yeah, you need to do that." And so it really looks like there'd been almost things arranged.
Yes.
And I step into it, and it's natural. It's a thing to do. It comes automatic. It just it just happens, you know. And you know it doesn't just happen, but my whole life seems to have been worked out that way.
Kind of like a setup.
Yeah, it really is. I got a picture from my sister in January for my 82nd birthday, and there's this little tow-headed kid in a homemade, custom-made pair of bib overalls, custom-made by my mom, and there was a shirt that was custom-made by my mom out of a flour sack, of course, right? And this two-year-old pumpkin head is standing on the porch looking out at the world, kind of, and Sis puts underneath it, "What a journey, from 2 to 82, what a journey." And Jordan was 352 people. I lived there for the first 5 years of my life. And how do you escape from that? How do you get out of that? Who directs that trail, that path, that journey? So I've had some help. I've had somebody move along with me, and it seems like things that I need to do just show up and knock on the door. And I say, come on in, let's see what we can do.
And that's the exact opposite of having, which is football, which is strategize, plan, execute, discipline. It's almost the entire opposite.
You know, I think I can blame my mother for a large amount of this, because she was the lady that took care of all the children in the neighborhood. When the girls got in a little trouble or had some difficult times or whatever it happened to be, Mom would invite them over and set them down, get them a cup of tea. And her first comment was, "Let's see what we can do." And she immediately owned the problem and shared the problem and helped solve the problem. And I saw her do that a number of times. And if it comes from anywhere, John, it comes from Myrtle.
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 It's the Myrtle download.
The Myrtle.
At 82, you look, you know, 72. And I think part of it is to do with what you do for a living and how you go about your living. I don't think you've ever, as long as I've known you, ever confused who you are with what you do. You've been able to separate them. I was a football player. I was very good at it, but I'm also this. And one of the other rails that runs along the track, the Kramer track, has been this insatiable curiosity you had about health. I mean, they called you Zipperhead for a reason. Because there's a guy to figure out the health aspect. Yeah. You're the walking embodiment of that.
Well, you know, I had a interest in... I shot myself with a double-barrel 10-gauge early and ran a stick through my groin that entered the front of the groin above the leg and came within a half inch of coming out my back, chipped vertebrae to touch the retinas, concussions, odds and odds and ends and all that kind of stuff. And... I was talking to a couple guys about an anti-aging clinic here about 2007, and we've got the money raised, and we got a couple million bucks if we want to start a clinic. And I'm going, well, I don't know much about that. I don't know much about aging. I don't know much about whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. So my great pal Art Preston was putting up the funds, and I said, Art, I really don't know if I want to do this. And he said, well, how would you find out? I said, I think I would visit a half a dozen universities and talk to the people who are in the labs and who are doing research on it, like the guy at the University of Wisconsin, Jamie Thompson. He isolated the embryonic pluripotent stem cell in the Petri dish in 1998. And he said, well, go talk to him. So I called Harvard. I talked to David Sinclair, who was the head of the lab for the study of aging and had just isolated a substance called resveratrol, found in red wine. And it had anti-aging implications for yeast, worms, fish, mice. Didn't work for humans, but it worked on some of the creatures. And I went to MIT with Dr. Lenny Garante, who had been lab at the study of aging since 1982. So he gave me 4 hours, as did Dr. Sinclair, as did the guy at Stanford and Cal. And Dr. Jamie Thompson took me through his lab, showed me a bunch of critters. After we had 3 or 4 hours of conversation, he took me into the back room and there were a bunch of critters scurrying around in a cage. And he goes, Jerry, you know what those are? I said, they look like salamanders. He said, they are. What do you know about a salamander? They make good bass bait. He said, beyond that, what do you know? He said, well, did you know that they can regrow an arm, a leg, or a tail? I said, you know, Doc, I might have known that as a young kid, but I'm not sure. But it seems like I did know that. So what are you doing? We think the ability of the salamander to regrow a limb is stem cell based. And that's going to be my next project.
Hmm.
And I go, wow.
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 From bass bait to regrowing limbs. Limbs,
yeah. And he takes me down into his lab, and we talk about the Human Genome Project, which was a 13-year project.
Right.
Cost $3.1 billion, was finished in 2002. And he's trying to tell me how this works. And I said, well, what do you do, Doc? How do you know? He said, well, my computer programmer helped me with the stem cells. And he said, Jerry, you remember the Human Genome Project? And I go, yeah, kinda.
Yeah.
How long did it take? I don't know, Doc. It was 8 or 9 years. I don't know exactly, but it was a long time. He said, Jerry, it was 13 years. And it cost $3.1 billion. And it finished in 2002. This is 2007. And he says, I got a computer in my basement now that can do that in 3.5 hours.
Come on.
3.5 hours.
Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So that whole world just fascinated me. It was just incredible. And the whole stem cell research thing is unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a fantasy land almost. You can regrow almost every part of your body, from your eyes, your ears, your teeth, your hair, your cartilage, your bones, your knees, your almost everything.
It's interesting how it's kind of come full circle. So you go out and there's a problem, and then you try to find some sort of medicine to fix the problem, and you come back to the human body that knows how to fix the problem.
Yeah.
So with full disclosure, you've been telling me, yeah, I'm just coming back from getting another stem cell shot. So you're an advocate. I mean, you're one thing to be interested in it, but you're the Kramer guinea pig here.
I got to go find out, John. I found a guy in Florida about 5 years ago who was a orthopedic surgeon, and he was giving stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, he's a bright man. He's head of the Orthopedic Society of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to go to Florida and get a stem cell injection. So I did, and I've been to probably about 5, 6, 7 injections now, and I've learned a little bit more each time, and it's just absolutely fascinating. And I'm involved with a group now out of Salt Lake called Predictive Technology Group that harvests embryonic pluripotent stem cells from the hospital.
I don't know that I could spell pluripotent, but go ahead.
pluripotent.
Very good. You get a cookie.
That particular stem cell is brand new and fresh and the most powerful, capable kind of stem cell you can find.
And this is from I'm gonna say unused portion of birth and stuff like that. This
Correct.
Is harvested in a very respectful way.
In the hospital, after genetic testing, after full term, after everybody in the world knows about it and agrees that it's worthwhile to do, then it's harvested.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
It's very, very well done. Yeah. FDA-approved labs and all that. So they're doing a wonderful job, and they're just creating miracles. They're doing things and they're not $30,000 like some of the con men out there.
Yeah, the stuff that makes the headlines.
They're like $1,200 to $1,500, maybe $2,000
tops. Yeah, yeah.
And they're doing it on a consistent basis for the long term, not the short term. They're in it for a long term.
I can't sit and watch the news anyway, but it seems like from 6 o'clock to 6:30, it's not the news, it's infomercials for medicine with the news shoved in it. What you're talking about is a different approach to this, to healing.
Yeah, this is a very natural approach with very natural products. The stem cell is something that we know about half of. You know, we don't know how far it can go, what it can cure yet. We're still learning, but we have learned a great deal. And we will learn a great deal more. But it's one of the great miracles in the history of medicine. and I believe we're just beginning to uncover the capabilities of it. I think there's a lot of other applications in the years ahead that we will learn about, and I think it's just the right place, the right type of stem cells. There's about 8 or 9 different types. Now, you got to be careful about where you go and who harvests the stem cells and how and on and on and on. And that's exactly what this group does.
And what's the name again of the
Predictive Technologies Group.
Salt Lake City.
Yeah. They're a wonderful group. They're a moral group. They're honest and integrity and decency and all of that. And I've been looking at them for 6 months and finally decided to join them a little bit.
Well, once again, you get all kind of jacked up here, you know, with this stuff. And it's a good thing. I mean, I know people half your age that don't have this energy, and I'm watching. You're almost out of the chair here talking about this stuff. We're with my friend Jerry Kramer. We're in Milwaukee, and I guess we got the whole room reserved at the Homewood Suites here, which is great. I don't know how the acoustics are. If you're hearing ambient noise, people have been walking through. They're cleaning up. They're doing their thing. I drove up from Chicago, short hour and 15-minute drive, and as we get ready to kind of bring this down to another level, I think it kind of ties into everything we've been talking about. I didn't want to spend much time on the actual game of football. We beat that to the ground. Good to go. A couple years ago, we did an event called Lessons from Lombardi. And I had the idea because I've always felt, and you've told me this, that you seem to be more obligated than anybody else to do this stuff because of how hard he was on you. The times that he, you know, you wanted to quit and you didn't. I think you said at one point, like, you had a picture of him in your office, and he's, you know, you can't get away from it. So all these years later, I have never once, if you said, I've seen wavering but never faltering.
You know, the lessons were so strong, Johnny, and so meaningful. And why every young child doesn't get a list of them, I don't know. But I had no idea that preparation, I knew it was important. I mean, if I had to lift something, I had to have a certain amount of weight, a certain amount of strength, a certain amount of this, and a certain amount of intelligence, and where to put it and how to do it, and on and on and on. But I just didn't equate it to your overall lifespan and find that if you wanted to be successful, there was a price to pay for achievement, for accomplishment, for moving ahead in the world. And that price was preparation, commitment, consistency, discipline, pride, character, tenacity, belief in yourself and your organization. Those are the things that are cornerstones of a successful person. And if I had a wonderful experience with my 5-year-old. I'm careful with my children about spanking them. I want to spank them maybe twice in their lifetime, so that if I say don't step off that curb, they won't. So I'm very aware of the whole process of raising children now. And my baby was about 5 years old in springtime, and Mama wanted us to move some wood off the porch back out by the garage. And I said, yeah, Jordy and I can handle that. Come on, Jordan. He goes, nee, 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 and he starts whining and snotting and crying and carrying on. And I said, come on, I'll haul you stack. So I hauled a wheelbarrow full of wood, and he's whining, and I haul another wheelbarrow full of wood, and I look down, and there's 2 pieces stacked. And it's been about 10 minutes or so, right? And I go, I'm going to have to make a statement here. You know, he's just whining, and he's being difficult, and he doesn't want to do what we're doing. And my dad would whale my booty in a heartbeat, and I could do that, you know. But maybe I can try some of that positive stuff. Vince Lombardi Jr. and I had been to a self-image psychology seminar in Seattle. Tough to say.
I was going to say, that's impressive. I won't even try it. Keep going.
But we talked about positive wizards and negative motivation versus and coercive motivation versus positive motivation. And I'm going, well, I can try some of that positive stuff on him. I can always whale his backside if I have to, but I'll try this. So he's got 2 stick stacks, and I'm bringing my 3rd load over, and I decided, Jordy, I didn't know you could stack wood that good. That is perfect. They're right together. They're against the garage. They're even with the outside of the garage. Good job. I went and got another load, and came back, took a little extra time. Every stick was stacked. He's sitting on a round. He's got his chin in his hand, his elbow on his knee, and he's flipping his foot, bored to death, because he doesn't have anything to do. Now, total transformation after about 7 or 8 seconds of approval. It's stunning, John. Stunning. Two or three more loads, and every load was stacked. Every time I come back, he's sitting on the round again, and we go in.
Waiting on pop.
Now, everything is stacked. So he grabs my hand, and we go in the house, and he goes, "Mom, Dad and I took care of that old wood pile. That wasn't nothing. We did this, and we did that, and we did. He's proud of himself. He feels good about himself. He feels good about Dad. And that's what Coach Lombardi did, something similar to that. The approval, approval, Johnny, approval for virtually anybody is critical to life. We're a herd of people. We're a group. We're a tribe. We've always been in groups, and we always look for other people to say we're okay, that, yeah, there is approval. So approval and belief in the individual are two of the most powerful motivational forms I've ever found.
And it's hard to find these days, because it seems what grabs the headlines is the flamboyant and the big and the you can do this in three steps. And I don't know anybody that I have ever worked with in any of my careers or callings that had an easy route. And I found the ones that didn't last long. So we're selling this over here, but what really works is very challenging and very difficult at times, and it doesn't sell as well. Authenticity doesn't have the same price tag as the headlines that make it seem easy.
Yeah, but there is a price to pay. It isn't an IQ, it's an energy level. It's a burn, it's a hunger, it's a drive, it's a want, it's a fire that makes you go, not your IQ. You can find people with IQ that can help you along the way if you have the burn, if you have the want.
They'll show up. When we've concluded that Lessons from Lombardi event, which was just, it was a great thing. I could see, I've been on stage many, many times in my life. What I don't always see is once we finished, we had a little clip of Coach talking in the dark, and we brought the lights up. Remember this? And you were sitting on that chair, and you leaned into the crowd. And as you started talking, the crowd leaned into you. And I thought, look at this. And you were talking to them in a way that after an hour of all the ground we covered was so, they were so tied in and bought into the message that I knew it was, they were being infused with this, and nobody knew what they were going to, what they were in for when they showed up. Nobody, I didn't even know. I don't think you knew. And so when this thing was finished, you've been with people for so long and you spread this stuff. I've never asked you this question. I think once we talked a little bit about faith and God and religion years ago, and you know, everybody finds their own way, but do you find this, even what we're doing today, there's going to be thousands of people listening to this podcast that may never meet you in person. It's a way to kind of get the message out. Do you feel this is kind of like your salvation to do these things?
I think there's an approval by somebody up there. And I think I feel good when I do these kind of things. And Bart Starr taught me this.
Really?
Believe it or not. I had a religious conversion in grade school, high school, early in my life. But I didn't follow it like I should have, right? And I'm watching Bart, and Bart does everything right. He has a prayer breakfast with the ladies in the morning at breakfast. He has a luncheon with the business people at noon. He has a beer with the guys in the evening. And everything is perfect. And I don't know if I believe Bart Starr. I don't think I've ever met anybody that good. And I'm going to watch him. I'm going to catch him one of these days doing something wrong, right? I watched him for years. And I finally threw in with him, John, driving home one night from a charity golf event, and didn't get paid, didn't make any money, but had a lovely time. And I feel buoyant. I feel good. I'm just, everything about me feels good and up, and I'm going, what is this about? Well, you were with the guys. Well, I've been with the guys before. Well, I had a couple beers maybe. Well, I've had a couple beers before, but I didn't feel this good. And finally, I'm driving on down the road, and this little voice says, it's the people. He says, what do you mean, it's the people? the people are good people. They're trying to do good things. They're doing positive things. Jerks don't come to these events. Just people who are trying to give back, who are trying to make a difference, who are convinced that there's an afterlife and there's another life and that you ought to be a decent human being while you're going down the road. So those are the kind of people that come to charity events, and those are the kind of people that contribute and help out and make life just a little bit better. So I decided I wanted to be one of those people. And the more I contributed to charity, the better I felt. And so I was getting paid by feeling good and doing good. And it's a addictive process. The more you do it, the more you impact other lives, the better you feel.
I'm going to do what I did at the Lessons for Lombardi event. I'm going to give you the mic. There's thousands of people listening in all circumstances. And I don't know if we can actually recreate what you said that night, but it was very profound. But for all the people listening now, they're in dire straits, that are up against it, it's difficult, life's kicking their ass, they can't find a way out, they forgot who they are, their back is up against it. Any more metaphors you need? I'd like you to just finish this up.
You know, there's a attitude, again, it's a mindset as much as anything. And William Jennings Bryan, the great orator, said success in life is not so much a matter of chance as it is a matter of choice. Coach Lombardi said, you don't do things right once in a while. You do them right all the time. I love the poem Invictus, Johnny, that is always on my mind. Goes something like, out of the night that covers me, dark as a pit from pole to pole, I thank the Lord above for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. And under the bludgeonings of fate, my head is bloody but unbowed. In this pale of gloom and tears looms but the shadow of the glade. And yet the passing of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll, I am the master of my fate, and I am the captain of my soul. And you out there listening are the master of your fate, and you are the captain of your soul. Coach Lombardi said, finally, after the game is over, stadium lights are out, the parking lot's empty, you're back in the quiet of your room, all alone. Championship ring is on the dresser. The only thing left at this time is to lead a life of excellence and quality and try to make this old world just a little bit better place because you were in it. Try to make this old world a little bit better place because you were in it.
I hope you enjoyed that. I did. Sitting in that hotel in Milwaukee doing this interview, having this conversation, we were the only two in the dining area. It hadn't really opened yet. There was a couple chefs walking around, a couple other people, and we had some coffee sitting there. And we had this cavernous room to ourselves. And towards the end, a couple of people kind of filtered it, and they realized who was speaking, and Jerry was off to the side. And they kind of moved into a hallway, and they're listening over our shoulder. And I'm thinking, here it is again. You know, there's no off switch with this stuff, and it's not a fad. It's not something that, it's not a course you take. It's not an online, virtual, motivational, blah, blah, blah thing. This is how you really live your life. Because I've known the man 30 plus years, and I'm still learning things from him every time we have a conversation. And thanks once again for listening to the Life 2.0 podcast. Until next time, safe travels.